This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. President Trump has canceled that highly anticipated June summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to discuss ridding the peninsula of nuclear weapons.
If and when Kim Jong-un chooses to engage in constructive dialogue and actions, I am waiting. In the meantime, our very strong sanctions, by far the strongest sanctions ever imposed, and maximum pressure campaign will continue.
This move came just hours after North Korean Vice Foreign Minister released a statement calling Vice President Mike Pence a political dummy and emphasizing North Korea's arsenal power. President Trump's cancellation of the summit came hours after North Koreans say they dismantled their nuclear test site. North Korea allowed a select group of international journalists to watch engineers destroy enclosed tunnels at the test site where the country has conducted all six of its nuclear tests. But there was no independent outside nuclear monitors invited to verify the dismantlement of the site. So what happens now? Joining us, Don Hellman, professor emeritus at the Jackson School of International Studies at UW, an expert on North Korea. He spent time there, and he held the first international academic conference there back in 2005. So, Don, what do you make of the president's decision to cancel the summit?
My first point would be that it was personalized. It was rhetorical. That is, as you rightly point out, it was in response to a couple of announcements by the North Koreans that, you know, not only insulted the vice president and indicated they would, that the North would never give up nuclear weapons, but, you know, Trump himself had a coin minted with profiles of himself and Kim Jong-un and had led cheers to give himself the Nobel Peace Prize without having done adequate preparation. I brought with me a book called The Book of Insults, which I think is maybe the psychiatric level at which this thing should be understood. But to shift to the diplomatic side of things, is that no preparation was really done. For example, Mr. Secretary of State Pompeo is the person who has been to North Korea twice now, and he is the only person, since there is no Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs, there's no ambassador and no negotiator. It was his responsibility to establish what denuclearization really meant.
And as I understand it, the process of a major summit like this with two world leaders usually takes quite a long time to arrange. This was being arranged quite hastily compared to the usual process.
Not only is that true, the very concept of a summit was first devised in the modern era in World War II when there was agreement on who was going to win. That's the war. Since then, they've become photo ops, and clearly they are meaningless unless you do detailed preparation as to where you're going. And we did not even the most elemental have preparation.
I want to go back to the statement from the North Korean vice foreign minister. He not only called the vice president a dummy, but it was fairly fiery rhetoric. He said, he referenced the military attack, saying, quote, "We can also make the U.S. taste an appalling tragedy it has neither experienced nor even imagined up to now," end quote. Now, is this uncommonly harsh for North Korean political rhetoric?
That's why I brought the Book of Insults. North Korea has set new standards for outspoken hyperbolic statements that perhaps is now being matched by our own president, who treats members of his cabinet and his opponents in Washington similarly. What that statement you read, however, really means is that they are not going to denuclearize all at once. It's going to be a phased denuclearization, and the agenda for such phasing was never even systematically addressed.
Now, the cancellation of the summit by the president came just hours after North Korea says it destroyed its only nuclear test site. Should we take that assertion by North Korea at face value?
Well, as you implied in your introductory remarks, the only comment I've heard from anybody who witnessed it was that they blew up tunnels for observation purposes and the barracks in which the people that worked there lived. It's symbolic. It's proper. It is brilliant kind of symbolic diplomacy, but it has very little to do whether they either have a nuclear capacity that does not require further testing, or they have a second place where they can do it. They surely are going to hide them in tunnels and elsewhere. So I would take that as simply symbolic and surely not anything more than that.
The on-again, off-again North Korea-South Korea relationship appears to have warmed a little bit. Where does this leave that relationship now that the president has pulled out of the summit?
That's a very interesting question, because one of the major defects of our personalizing this and suddenly is that we consulted no one. The North Koreans were absolutely blindsided by this. They have, of course, Mr. President Moon has earnestly promoted contacts of any sort with North Korea. Indeed, the South Koreans announced our summit, if you can believe this. We didn't announce it. They did it for us in front of the White House. It puts them in an awkward position, but the long-term implications are that certainly of Kim Jong-un and even Moon is that this puts a strain on the American-South Korean alliance, because if some kind of amicable unification can take place, the foundation has been laid, and I think this will be confusing more than anything else to the South Koreans.
You know, the president alluded in his statement to these harsh sanctions placed on North Korea. Is there any indication that those sanctions are successful at bringing the North Koreans to the table?
The president has stressed this hard line, and John Bolton has emphasized it as well. The sanctions that really count are imposed by China. The North Korean conventional forces can have enough energy to fight for 30 days. If the war went beyond it, China would have to provide more. They provide an enormous amount of food, which really just props up the regime. And they also, of course, do 80% of the trade. So any settlement has to involve China, and the most telling sanctions, obviously, are imposed by the Chinese. Now, we are imposing tariffs on China, and of course, Kim brilliantly went to Beijing initially, and then the Chinese, kind of upset that Trump was acting alone, invited him back to Dalian for yet another meeting, at which point they probably loosened their sanctions on the North and gave them some more leverage to deal with us.
Now, Trump left the door open for talks with North Korea. He said this morning it's possible that the existing summit could take place or a summit at some later date. What do you think the potential is for a future summit right now?
Well, first of all, the Korean situation has to be understood in the context of both security and the political economy of Northeast Asia, not just how we deal with Kim Jong-un or how President Trump gets on with him.
Yeah.
And so the answer to your question really involves giving priority and sophistication to our overall policy toward that region. And we've got a lot of work to do to adjust that, especially with China, as well as our allies in Japan, as well as South Korea. The future possibility of this would require not just adjusting to the personality of Kim, but to this broader issue.
Don Hellman, Professor Emeritus at the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington, telling us what happens now that Trump has canceled the summit with North Korea. Don, thanks so much for coming by. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Up ahead, a federal court has ruled that President Trump has violated the First Amendment rights of people he banned on Twitter. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's The Record. As is often the case, President Trump broke the North Korea news on his Twitter feed, writing, quote, "Sadly, I was forced to cancel the summit meeting in Singapore with Kim Jong-un," end quote. That's 79 characters of breaking news, 79 characters that one Seattleite couldn't see because the president blocked her on Twitter. Yesterday, a federal court ruled that President Donald Trump has violated U.S. citizens' First Amendment rights by blocking them on Twitter. Once you're blocked, you're kept from appearing on the president's profile page, friends' timeline, or anywhere else. That one Seattleite that we know of who was blocked from Donald Trump's Twitter feed is Holly Figueroa O'Reilly, founder of Blue Wave Crowdsource. It's an organization that supports Democratic candidates. Holly, how did you get blocked by the president?
Hi, Ross. Thanks for having me. That's a really good point. I didn't know that he announced it on Twitter originally. I was blocked. I found out that I was blocked because I used to have his tweets come into my telephone, my cell phone. Anytime he would tweet, I would get a notification.
Okay.
And I wasn't getting notifications for a full day. One day last May.
And that would be a rare day when there wasn't a Trump tweet.
On my computer and found out that not only was I blocked, but at least 10 of my friends were blocked as well.
Now, why do you and a federal judge apparently feel that your First Amendment rights were abridged by President Trump when he blocked you from his Twitter feed? I think we might have lost Holly. We're going to try to get her back. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW. Feeling crowded yet? Seattle has gained more than 100,000 new people since 2010. As of 2017, Seattle became the fastest growing city in America, according to new census data. All that growth has caused an affordability crisis in the region. Home prices, rent, cost of living has all soared in the last decade. But as a city grows less affordable, why don't people leave? People in the U.S. have a long tradition of pulling up roots and moving when things got tough or better opportunities beckoned. They took the Oregon Trail to settle the Pacific Northwest. In the Great Migration, 6 million African Americans moved from rural southern United States to the cities in the Northeast, Midwest, and West. But in 2018, Americans are moving at the lowest rate on record. Why is that? Well, the Census Bureau shows the main reason is that millennials aged 25 to 35 are moving significantly less than earlier generations of young adults. Now, that seems counterintuitive because millennials are less likely to be married, own a house, and have kids. Those are factors that prevent people from moving. So if millennials are less tied down by spouses, houses, and kids, why are they moving at a lower rate? Why do they stay when faced with housing prices? They're rising at a precipitous rate. Emily Badger writes for the New York Times Upshot section. That's the section that covers cities and urban policy. Emily Badger is based in San Francisco. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
People are worried about affordable housing and its availability. People who are worried about that here, they look at San Francisco as even worse than we are, as a warning of what we don't want to become. Sketch out for us, how hard is it to find affordable housing in your city?
You know, it is incredibly hard here. And, you know, many people still sort of find a way to live here. But the things that they're doing in order to make that happen, I think would really be sort of surprising and shocking to people in other parts of the country where affordable housing is not so much of an issue. But, you know, we have people here dividing up what are supposed to be two-bedroom apartments into, you know, four or five bedrooms, treating the dining room and the living room as a bedroom. That's quite common if you just sort of look on Craigslist in San Francisco. There's a lot of overcrowding in housing here, you know, multiple families sort of dividing up a single house. There's, of course, a substantial homeless problem here of people who are sort of spilling out because they can't find housing. And, you know, all of this is a result of the fact that fundamentally at the end of the day, you know, we're talking about a market where a one-bedroom, you know, might go for $2,500, $3,000 a month. You know, that's an amount of rent that becomes unaffordable, not just to low-income people, but to middle-income people.
Oh, this is a very familiar story for folks in Seattle. If it's so hard to find affordable housing, then let's talk about why so many people are staying. Now, is one reason the fact that it costs a lot of money to move?
Sure, it costs a lot of money to move, but also we're talking about people potentially moving to places where if you don't have a college degree, if you're working in a lower skilled job, you're just not going to get paid as much. I mean, the minimum wage in San Francisco is about the highest in the country. You're going to get paid potentially twice as much here for a service sector job as you would if you were to move somewhere in the middle of the country where the housing is a lot cheaper. So, you know, the economic calculation is not quite as simple as it seems when we say people should just move where the housing is cheaper, because invariably where the housing is cheaper, the jobs aren't as plentiful, they don't pay as well, You know, you're not going to get sick leave, you're not going to get health care, other benefits that are mandated by the government in San Francisco. So, you know, it's a much more complicated decision than I think people think when they're simply looking at these incredible rents and saying people should just leave.
Well, is the housing cheaper other places? I've read that for the poorest renters, people making less than 30% of a region's median income, there's a shortage of affordable housing virtually everywhere in America, not just in San Francisco, not just in Seattle. Is that true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that statistic refers to households that make less than 30% of the median income in whatever community we're talking about. So these are not just the poor, but these are sort of the very low income. And for that population, there is a shortage of affordable housing virtually everywhere in America. So if we're talking about a really poor family in Seattle or San Francisco, you know, picking up and moving to someplace like Kansas City is not necessarily going to solve this problem for them. So on the one hand, that's a problem that's happening everywhere in the country. But what we start to see in places like San Francisco and Seattle and New York is that, you know, we're not just talking about people below 30% of the median income who can't afford housing. Now we're talking about 50, 80, 100, even 120%. You know, what's so unique about these situations is that affordable housing crisis has very, you know, sort of methodically creeped its way up the income spectrum.
I'm speaking with Emily Badger, who writes for the New York Times. You talked to someone in San Francisco about the affordability issue, a woman named Maya Mack, and her story kind of personifies what we're talking about. Could you tell that story?
Yeah, so she is living with her 7-year-old daughter with her mother and several other family members in the house where she grew up. And it's a very crowded situation. You know, she and her daughter don't have their own bedrooms. They don't even have their own beds. And I asked her, you know, why would you not consider moving somewhere else entirely, leaving the Bay Area? And, you know, she did not have to think about the answer to this for more than 2 seconds before she told me, you know, no, that would be really foolish of me, because if I were to move somewhere else, I would really be struggling. You know, maybe I wouldn't be struggling financially, but she would be struggling as a single mom in a community where she doesn't know anyone, where she doesn't have family support, where she doesn't have, you know, the sisters around her who help her take care of her daughter when she needs babysitting. You know, she is really deeply embedded in a social network in this community, and, you know, that's an incredibly valuable thing. I think it's often the case that people who don't have a lot of money have this other thing that's of value that we don't recognize, which is, you know, social connections, support. You know, they're embedded in communities, and that's a big part of what holds people in place, too.
So with people who are rich moving in and people who can't afford the city not able to leave, they have to stay behind and it's a struggle. How is that changing the character of San Francisco?
You know, it definitely is true that this is becoming a wealthier city, that, you know, the homeless problem is growing more acute. People are tremendously worried about it. You know, it really, this question of how do we create more affordable housing, how do we protect housing for people who grew up here, is kind of all-consuming in the politics of the city, which I think is probably going to feel very familiar to people in Seattle. But, you know, I think it's people who worry that the character of the city is changing, that, you know, the economics of who can afford to live here is changing. You know, those people are not overreacting. They're not being hyperbolic. It is in fact the case that sort of the demographics and the nature of this place are changing as a result of the high cost of housing, making it very hard for certain kinds of people to stay here.
Emily Badger, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the time.
Emily Badger writes for the New York Times, The Upshot. It's the section about cities and urban policy. She is based in San Francisco. When we come back, we want to hear from you. What brought you to this growing city, and why do you stay? Call our number right now and share your story. It's 206-543-5869. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. New census data out has told us what we've been feeling for quite a while. Seattle is growing a lot. In fact, in 2017, Seattle was the fastest growing city in the nation. We'd like to hear from you. What brought you to this growing city? And why do you stay in the face of some of the problems that have arisen because of that? Call right now and share your story. We're at 206-543-5869. Here's what we heard from a few of you earlier today.
I moved here from Brooklyn, New York in 2016. And I moved here because I like the weather better. I thought the technology industry seemed more promising out here than back east. And the prices in Brooklyn were just getting too high.
I was looking for a job in youth ministry and one that specifically affirmed my LGBTQ identity and beliefs. And I found a church that was willing to do that. And in January, I packed up my car with everything I owned, and I drove across the country from North Carolina, and I've been here for 4 months now, and it's been great.
A recent transplant to the Pacific Northwest, actually. What brought me out here was a job opportunity, as I'm sure a lot of people. But what sold me was seeing Mount Rainier for the first time and just seeing all the raw nature that the Pacific Northwest has to offer. What's kept me out here are the people, the general laid-back attitude and acceptance that the Western Washington has to offer. And, of course, I met my amazing wife here, too, and I can say that this is truly my home now, and I don't think I can live anywhere else.
That's Ashley and Greg calling in. Share your story with us, why you came, why you stay. We're at 206-543-5869. The Evergrey is Seattle's indispensable newsletter with what's going on in the city and why it's happening. They've talked to a lot of newcomers about why they came and why they stay. Co-founder Monica Guzman-Preston's with us in the studio. Monica, welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
So what have you learned about what brings people here and what keeps them here?
Well, definitely a lot of it really is social networks, connections, the community ties that people make. So we heard everything from people's family roots and their cultures. We heard from someone whose family immigrated from Norway 100 years ago, and it's just felt like such a deep, entrenched thing. We heard, you know, from someone who said that their Frisbee community is just so great that she can't imagine, you know, leaving because she's found such great connections through that. And also we heard people talk about the values of Seattle and how much they match their own personal values, and that that's a really significant thing that makes them want to stay in this place. And then apart from that, you know, then there's sort of the more normal responses like inertia, you know, well, I'm here and it's fine, so I stay, which is certainly, you know, a real thing. Yeah, it's a really interesting question to kind of get the full range of answers to.
There's all kinds of reasons for coming, but then staying here becomes difficult because of the rise in price of housing for some folks. Are you picking up any kind of flavor of people who say they stay, but it's becoming a struggle?
Yes, absolutely. So many of the responses have been sort of, you know, positive and optimistic, but are at least laced with some of that, despite the fact that Seattle is where it is, despite the fact that it's getting more expensive. We did hear from one person, Ann Hilton, who told us that she was kind of done with Seattle, but her wife pushed her to stay, even though the high rental prices meant that they had to keep moving farther and farther out from Seattle. But she said that she stuck it out, and she found some communities she really liked. She got more civically involved, and now she's happy she stayed. But you could see that there was a crossroads there. And at some point, you know, if people just don't get what they need in terms of meaning and connections, it really may not be worth fighting and struggling to stay.
Well, it's tough if you make a certain amount of money, but I got to say for others, if you ask them why they stay, they might say, it's obvious. I love the new restaurants. I love all the new amenities, and I can afford them. Have you gotten any of that from folks who say, I stay here because it's clearly a better city for me as it grows and changes?
You know, specifically from that perspective of the change being solely a positive thing, we actually haven't heard that much. Mm-hmm. We have heard people tell us that they love where they are. They love their neighborhood. Someone who's been going to the same eatery for 25 years, you know, can't imagine leaving. But I think even for the people for whom it is not an immediate struggle, all the changes in Seattle, I think so many people are conscious of how it's a struggle for everybody else that it's hard to externalize it.
You can't not see tents pitched on the sidewalk. You can't not see those things. We're at 206-543-5869. Monica Guzman-Preston is with me. You read about from her in the Evergrey. And we're talking about that phenomenon of people who come here. Why did you come? And why do you stay? And is it a struggle? And maybe Monica hasn't heard from you, but maybe you're someone who says, it's obvious why I stay. I like what's happening to the city. I don't like all of it. I don't like the dislocation that's happening. But for me, it's still a great place to be. Maybe you've got that perspective or another. 206-543-5869. Let's go to Fletcher, who's joining us on the line. Fletcher, thanks for calling us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Which neighborhood are you calling from, Fletcher?
Dan.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Queen Anne, Upper Queen Anne.
Queen Anne, thanks for giving us a call. So what got you here, Fletcher? How long have you been here?
I came in 2006 for undergrad.
And why did you stay? A lot of folks leave after they've gone through their college years.
Primarily for family. My brothers are here, and my whole friend group from college stayed around here as well. So primarily for family.
And that connects you. That are you happy about staying here? Are you pleased to remain in the city despite some of the pressures?
Oh, I'm definitely feeling the pressure, and a radio program like this or this particular thing makes me start thinking, well, gee, you know, what is really keeping me here, and kind of makes me reevaluate. And I think I'm ready to kind of start looking elsewhere.
Wow. And what are the factors that make you think that way?
Primarily looking at, like, Craigslist housing, and that's really it. Like, I can afford groceries, but the housing makes me feel like I'm not getting a good deal.
You know, as we heard from San Francisco, a lot of people are overcoming that just by getting closer together, like sharing houses, splitting up apartments into smaller and smaller areas. Have you had to do that?
Yes, I have.
But at the same time, I would think that having your family here provides you with some kind of a cushion for that, does it?
Right. I feel a little bit like an imposition right now, even though they're very accommodating. So I'd like to be independent and not a burden, not that they tell me I am, but I'd like to kind of, yeah, be independent.
And when your thoughts go to moving, where do they take you to?
I don't know. I've heard the East Coast, the Carolinas, have great housing. I have a friend who lives out there. He tells me the prices for, like, renting a house, even, it's nuts. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's a lot cheaper.
Hey, Fletcher, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you just joined us, it's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. We're taking your stories about why you moved here and why you're staying. 206-543-5869. Monica Guzman-Preston is also here with us. And that story about family keeping Fletcher here, are you hearing that very much, that people kind of move here and it's the family connections that make them want to stay?
Yes, absolutely. We heard from one reader, Rani Nguyen, who said that her family is Vietnamese refugees, and they've found such a community in Little Saigon, and they couldn't imagine leaving it, right? Because not only is it culturally relevant, but you've also spent the time investing in those relationships. So we definitely hear that a lot, that for a lot of people, it takes time to get to know a place. It can take time to warm up to a place. So there's a cost when you extricate yourself from that and try to start over somewhere else. You have to invest that time all over again. And in some situations, you know, especially if you're part of a different culture, that the rewards of being connected to your culture within a city where your culture is not the majority are so great, and the cost would be so great to leave that, right? So it also depends on how important and how unique is that connection that you've made in Seattle, and what would it take for you to find it someplace else?
Monica, you've been covering this story for a long time at the Evergrey and elsewhere. When you got these responses in on why people came and why they stayed, did you look at any of them and go, did they surprise you? Did you look at any of them and go, wow, I hadn't thought about that before?
Oh, interesting. I will say, I don't know if it's true to say that it surprised me, but I am moved by how many people have values-based reasons for wanting to stay. For example, Philip Weiss, one of our readers, said, I want to stay here because I'm seeing a growing movement of people who care about urbanism and equity. All four generations of my family that lived here before me improved the city for the next, and this is how we'll improve it for the next one. There's a sense of mission there, right? So you asked me earlier, is anyone saying that they're excited about the changes because of the restaurants and whatnot? We didn't hear about those little things, but we did hear about, you know, the ingredients are here for something exciting, and we're having a hard time, but I want to stay because I see hope, and I think I can be part of making this place better.
We have the phone lines open at 206-543-5869. We've got Patricia on the line. Patricia, good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Where are you calling from, Patricia? What's your neighborhood?
I'm calling from Tacoma.
Oh, from Tacoma. Well, tell us a little bit about what got you to Tacoma and why you stay.
Well, actually, I went back to Seattle because of the illness of my father, and I was a caretaker for my father.
Huh.
And that moved me back to Seattle.
I see. And is your father still with us?
No, he's not.
I'm sorry to hear that. With that connection broken, why did you stick around? Why did you stay in Tacoma?
Well, actually, I moved from Seattle to Tacoma because I could no longer afford Seattle.
I see. And has the move worked out for you? Do you find it a more affordable city? You're able to live in a place you like in a way that you could not do here?
Well, I made the decision to move to Tacoma after I realized that my friends were just 20 minutes away by drive, but by traffic, so that's an hour away back to Seattle.
That's right. It takes an awful long time to get back and forth. And is your living situation in Tacoma appreciably better than the kind of housing you're able to afford here in Seattle?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I lived in the Central District for many years. I was actually born at Providence Hospital in the Central District. We moved to Columbia City before it became the Columbia City it is today. And then we moved to Kent. And then now we move to Tacoma.
You know, I've just been reading that Pierce County is kind of posing itself as the anti-Seattle, trying to attract businesses there. And I'm wondering, in the time you've been in Tacoma, Patricia, have you noticed any of those same pressures that have really taken hold in Seattle beginning to take hold in Tacoma, specifically like rising housing prices, crowded buses, the kind of things that we see here? Is that happening where you are?
I believe it is. The Hilltop area is really coming along. There's a lot more development. They're restoring buildings. I see a lot of signs that say that they're hiring. I see more. It seems that there's more pedestrian traffic in Tacoma because I live relatively close to where I'm working. And the big push that made me move to Tacoma was because I am a social worker. And my income has been, I wouldn't say I'm making a lot of money.
Right.
But I could no longer afford living in Seattle.
It's sadly a story of all too many people. Patricia, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And Monica Guzman-Preston, co-founder and director of the Evergrey, a digital news publication in Seattle. Thank you so much for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW. Up ahead, a happy bus driver. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. I'm Ross Reynolds. It's KUOW, Sound Stories, Sound Voices. I'm in for Bill Radke today on The Record. Picture this. You're running late. You see your bus. One problem, it's the wrong end of the bus. Staring at the back of the vehicle, you break into a sprint, and in a stroke of luck, the driver sees you, but...
I know that everyone wants to hear that you, the bus driver, will lovingly stop and wait. The answer is a little more complicated.
That's Nathan Voss. He's an artist, a photographer, a filmmaker, and a bus driver. He's been driving for Metro since he was 21. That's the youngest you can start. And he sat down with me yesterday to talk about his career. Nathan, you were called one of the happiest bus drivers in Seattle. And I asked him how he found meaningful connections in those very short interactions with passengers.
I wonder if describing the very first time I was driving a route through Seattle, I had been raised on this idea that if you're nice to other people, they'll be nice to you in return. And I wanted to know, well, how far can you push that? Is it always true? Is it mostly true? Is it a falsehood? And I was doing this route where the very first stop was outside this methadone clinic on Airport Way. And this was a segment of the population I hadn't spent a lot of time with. And I decided, okay, let's just see what happens here. And I pulled up to the stop and I asked them all how they're doing. And they were by far the most responsive, appreciative of kindness passenger set of that whole route. And that was this wonderful opening up in my mind of, okay, wow, this really does work almost all the time.
One interesting thing about the route that you drive is it goes from South Seattle to North Seattle. It goes through these very different neighborhoods. Do you pick up different vibes from different areas that you drive through?
Very much so. And the reason I like the 7 and 49 combo so much is because it focuses so much on Broadway and Rainier Avenue, neither of which have the Seattle freeze, by and large. Very lively, high-energy group of folks out there. If I'm driving in Leschi or Upper Queen Anne, the folks out there aren't quite as prone to interact with each other, with myself, a little more withdrawn. And there's a study whose name I wish I could recall, but it pointed out that unsafe neighborhoods generally have the strongest sense of community because people have to rely on each other to be safe, to survive. And so when I'm driving through working class and low income neighborhoods, you notice a lot more people talking on the bus. And if I say hi to people on the 7, they absolutely do. They will say something in response. And I don't drive that route because it's more cool or whatever, more dangerous or something like that, but rather because the people are more friendly. If I'm going to spend 8 hours in one neighborhood, I want it to be somewhere where there's a lot of back and forth.
You've been driving a bus now for 11 years.
Indeed.
And over that time period, I don't know if it's just me, but I ride the bus every day. I've noticed a lot more people have their earphones on and they're looking at their phones and they're not paying attention to
anything.
Have you noticed that too?
I sure have, and it's not my favorite. I still do the thing where I say hi to every single person. I greet them in some fashion, every person getting on, regardless of whether or not they respond, because I'm doing my part, you know? And I don't need them to say hi back to me. Of course, it feels good when they do. But I feel like this city is one where people may not approach you to talk, but if you approach them, generally they'll respond in kind. I used to drive the route through Microsoft campus to transport those passengers back into Seattle where they live. And the crowd was disproportionately quiet, extremely withdrawn, and It was 3 months of driving that before I finally started to break these guys in. But at the end of that period, they were all saying thank you. And I think you sort of bring them around. It's in people's natural inclination to open up.
So you can break people in. You can break
it's
the
possible.
Freeze.
It's possible. I want to believe. It's me being optimistic here.
Now, do you associate with the people you meet on the bus very much off the bus?
It often happens by accident. I'll be in line at the grocery store and the woman in front of me will recognize me and we'll just explode with delight because we haven't seen each other in 3 years. And a recent incident like that just happened up at the Lake City Fred Meyer, where I wasn't paying attention to the person standing in front of me. And she turned around and recognized me and noticed me as the bus driver who used to drive her to her Ethiopian church in the Central District years ago, more than 5 years ago. And we used to have all these conversations about how she works at the airport and whatever else. And we were so excited to see each other. And the cashier, some college student, was so pleasantly confounded at how me and this short woman who looked and dressed and spoke entirely different than I do, how we were so excited to see each other. And that made it all the more exciting.
It's so interesting to see people out of the usual context.
Indeed. It's so satisfying to walk down Third Avenue and have all these faces that either I notice or they recognize me or we'll smile at each other or we'll say hi. And I find that super humbling. I want to see if I can continue to live up to their expectations and also try to be like those operators who have been able to maintain such a consistent good attitude for so long.
When you're driving a bus, it seems like a really difficult job to me because you're the fare collector. You're driving in busy traffic often. You're dealing with the fact that that's your primary job. Mm-hmm. And you're also kind of in charge of keeping order on the bus. Is that difficult at times?
It's very much this mental multitasking thing. And in that way, it's vaguely similar to film directing. You're balancing a bunch of things in your head, all of which are very important. And you've just got to do that. Like you say, you're driving up the street, you're thinking about traffic, you're thinking about turns and stopping distance. And if you're driving the trolley bus, you're thinking about staying on the wire above you. and you're monitoring the passengers inside. Maybe you're thinking about the fare collection. I actually tend to ignore that. You're thinking about schedule and people safely getting on and off. Meanwhile, you're holding a conversation with the person at the front of the bus while you're doing all of that. And it's so exciting. It's a rush of energy. And gosh, I get a lot out of it.
I'm talking to Nathan Voss. If you ride the 7 or the 49, you might recognize that voice. He's the bus driver there. He's also an artist, a filmmaker, a photographer. In fact, he's finishing up a film right now. You do art. You do gallery shows. You're a filmmaker. Are you a bus driver who does art, or are you an artist who drives a bus?
There's a friend of mine who was assistant vice principal at the University of Tehran, and here, where he now lives, he drives a bus, and none of his passengers know that he used to be in this high-ranking position, that he also is a cameraman for, he was cameraman for Q13 Fox and taught photography at Shoreline College. To the people getting on his bus, he's just some guy driving a bus, and he told me early on in my career, we are not bus drivers, we're driving a bus. There's more that defines us than our jobs. And I'm not married to either idea. I don't mind being considered a bus driver because some of the time I am, but I do so much else. I don't really know how people conceive of me because I wear these different hats. I've noticed when friends introduce me to their other friends, they almost always, if they're artists or painters or something, they'll say, "This is Nathan the bus driver." And then if I have bus driving friends, they'll say, "This is Nathan the filmmaker." Trying to make me interesting or something.
You said you've learned a lot from talking to other bus drivers.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of things have you learned from talking to bus drivers?
I am most impressed when people can maintain a good attitude for a long period of time. Everyone can be positive and helpful in all this for a short time, but when people can extend that over a long duration, years of their career, for example, I find that impressive. And so I like to ask them or listen or just ride their buses when I happen to be on one and watch how they do things and try to drink that in and sort of learn something. I also learned a lot from the passengers. I was driving the route on Aurora Avenue. At the time, it was a 358. And there are these two guys sitting behind me, and I'm listening to them one tell the other at southbound Aurora and Denny how this is the intersection where the speaker lost his legs. And he was describing the height of a Mercedes sedan's front bumper and how it intersects precisely with the area just below your knees. And that's from that point below, he didn't have any legs anymore. And he was explaining this to his companion with no anger or repressed feelings of negativity. And I thought to myself, wow, there is so much. I mean, these guys are so much better at being happy than I am. And I've just got no excuse. I'm so happy to be here where I can learn all this stuff. And I've been offered and encouraged to pursue other jobs within the organization, supervision and others. But I've said no to those because I like being in this job where there's no intermediary between you and the people you're helping. There's no filter. You're looking directly in the eyes of the person that you're offering assistance to. And I feel so, it feels good to feel useful, you know, like valuable and contributing some little thing to society, even if it's just a positive attitude for a few minutes.
Now, do certain bus lines have, do bus drivers have attitudes about certain bus lines? That's the line that's
definitely.
Yeah, like
everyone hates the 7. Nobody wants to do the E line, especially the 7 and 49 at night because it's long. The people are high maintenance, is I think a nice way to put it.
Explain that a little bit more.
Okay, sure.
The high maintenance.
I thought
people.
You might ask about that. You really got to do the work to be friends with these guys, because
it's not easy to be friends with them.
It takes sometimes it takes effort. Sometimes people will act entitled because they're not, or they will behave in a way that indicates minimal experience in terms of having a good parent figure is looking out for them, positive role models. they may be choosing not to solve or address large problems in their life by turning to Band-Aid solutions like drugs and alcohol. Yeah. And I try to stay on good terms with those folks for a couple of reasons. One is for my own benefit. It makes my day more pleasant. Another is that I'm reminded of something I was told very early on in training at this job, which is you've got to respect everyone, especially the people you think deserve it the least, because they are probably not getting a lot in the way of respect. Hmm. And sometimes you'll encounter folks who are on the down and out side of things and they feel invisible and they're trying not to be. And they're loud. They're trying to just get a response.
Sure.
And you can give them a response, and it can be a positive one.
You said something really interesting. People who act entitled because they're not.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go a little deeper with that. What do you mean by that?
I think when we talk about entitlement, we're often referring to the bourgeois upper class, just disregarding the needs of others. Let me think about this. There was a... This is a hypothesis. I believe when you have felt that you've been wronged by society or disregarded by it, you may feel less of a need to follow its rules. And you take that frustration out on others or yourself. Yeah.
You know, I've been seeing what I think is an example of that. People who look a bit disheveled, they might be homeless.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them kind of start walking across the street against traffic, against the light. When you said they feel entitled all because they're not, that made me think of those people I see doing that.
Littering is another great example. It's one of the few ways to exert agency over the space you're in if you don't have any other control of your space, if you don't have a place that you can call home or so on.
I ride the 44 every day. I love riding the bus. It makes my life so much more convenient.
Yeah.
Two things about riding buses, though.
Please.
One of which is bus drivers who drive with the stop and start thing.
It's Isn't that awful?
You're like, it's particularly terrible. If you're standing up, all of a sudden you're like falling over because they're jamming on the brake. What's up with that? Doesn't bus driver training account for that?
Indeed. And they try to emphasize it. They talk about feathering the brakes. That's the terminology they use. That basically just means go smooth. And I feel like the best bus drivers are those who also ride the bus, because then you know precisely how annoying it is when the guy slams on the brakes, when the guy doesn't wait for you and you're running for the bus, all of that good stuff. Yeah.
Second thing.
Please.
Bus drivers who block the intersection. They try to take a left. They do it one block from here, and they consequently block all the traffic at the intersection.
Yeah.
And nothing moves.
You know,
what's up with that?
Yeah. I like to... I guess I shouldn't make a joke about community transit bus drivers on air.
Oh, go ahead.
sometimes when those wonderful operators who don't get paid as much as us, sometimes their operating may reflect that. And you'll see them blocking the intersections on 4th Ave. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, let's not be a community transit bus driver here. Let's like have a little bit of class. I do know some CT operators who I love. I'm sorry. In their defense, it can be a difficult push-pull situation sometimes. You know that your bus needs 40 or 60 feet to cross the intersection. And often what will happen is cars will sort of dive in before you can get the power to cross the intersection and fill up that space. And you have a couple choices. You can sit there for 3 or 4 light cycles waiting for something to happen.
Yeah, passengers love that.
I know, yeah. Or you can go out there after you've sat through one light cycle and realized that this isn't going to work unless you just go out there. I cannot express how embarrassing it feels to be sitting out there blocking everything, making everyone feel horrible.
Not you, Nathan. Don't tell me.
Exactly. Never. I'm just speaking hypothetically here. This never happened. I usually will sit for a full light cycle, maybe two. And if nothing happens,
boom,
I'll improvise.
You're out there.
And maybe that means doing something in the intersection that is technically lawful, but annoying. yeah.
Okay, Nathan, you're driving and you realize that someone is running for the bus.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
Great question. So I know that Everyone wants to hear that you, the bus driver, will lovingly stop and wait. The answer is a little more complicated. If I'm doing a route that comes every 10 minutes or every 4 minutes, like the 41 in rush hour or the 3-4 combo, which comes every 8 minutes, I tend not to wait because I'm probably already a couple minutes late. So they have maybe 6 minutes or 2 minutes until the next bus comes. So I'm defeating the purpose of frequent service if I wait for every single person. That's how you end up with situations where you have like 3 buses of the same route coming all at the same time. The first one's packed, the 2 behind it are empty. Now, however, if I'm driving the 131 at nighttime to Burien, which is hourly, I'm going to wait for everybody in King County to get on the bus because who would want to wait an hour for a bus? I've done it. It doesn't feel great.
Nathan Voss, he's a bus driver. You can catch him on the 7 and the 49. His blog is called View from the Bus. Also, check out his webpage. He's an artist, a filmmaker, a photographer, a writer, and as you can tell, a storyteller. Thank you so much for joining us.
Ross, great to be here. Thank you so much.
That's all, folks. The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Rempong, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer, Bree Ripley. I'm Ross Reynolds. Thanks for listening. I'll be here again tomorrow for Bill Radke on The Week in Review with Cairo TV's Essex Porter, former state GOP chair Chris Vance, Erica C. Barnett. The C stands for crank. Please join us.